everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, along with Denise Miller, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow Pullman. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latah and Whitman Recovery Community Centers. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. The Latah Recovery Community Center is located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRCC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. Their hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Whitman Recovery Community Center is located at 226 East Main Street in Pullman. And you can contact the WRCC by phone at 509-715-1111 or by email at wrccprogrammanager@gmail.com. And their hours are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. Like I said earlier, I am Radio Johnny, and she is Miss Denise Miller. Hello, Denise.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening today.
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah, we do this for a reason. We hope we're getting some good information out to people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, here and online. It's pretty amazing. We're getting some decent feedback, too, so I'm happy about that. And let's see, the calendar, you can go online to the LatahRecoveryCenter.org website and look that up there. We're into April now, and the new calendar should be up.
Yeah, and actually I wanted to say something about that real quick. So for the month of April, and I think this might go into May as well, AA is going down to just being on Friday at noon. Right. And so Sean and I have been thinking about, like, what could we do to kind of help in that spot a little bit in case there's still some people coming in. And as of right now, we are working on having some kind of recovery, kind of out of a workbook, on Tuesdays from 1 to 2, and then also on Thursdays from noon to 1. And there are some new things on the calendar this month, so we do hope that you would go check it out.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. I know being involved in the AA community that I've been hearing about that for a while, and I'm glad you thought to mention it too.
Yeah, and
because it has kind of been a staple every day at noon for a long time.
And I also want to mention that currently at noon on Mondays, Sean is here and he does currently have some availability. And we really do want to be able to support you if you come in at noon and you're looking for a meeting or to be able to talk with someone. So if you come in and there's nothing going on, please ask the person at the front desk. There should be someone here to talk to you.
Good. Cool. Cool. And another note here coming up in a week and a couple of days is going to be the Mental Health Walk, which I believe is associated with the Latah Area Alliance on Mental Illness, LAMI. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be on April 11th, Saturday. They're going to meet up at Friendship Square. And rally and check-in is at 10 a.m. They're going to have a costume contest, so I guess that is,
there you go.
Ensures you should wear a costume of some sort.
A little extra fun.
Yeah, and that's at 11:30. And then the walk, 5K, begins at 12:30. And you can get more information on that at www.dacnw.org. And I think that stands for Disability Action Center Northwest.org.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So go out there and check it out. You can have someone sponsor you. You can make donations. It should all be available on their website. But again, that's coming up a week from this Saturday on the 11th.
Yeah, that should be fun.
It should be a ball, yeah. I've heard some good things about it. Mm-hmm. I think I even went on one of them. It was quite a while ago, but
nice.
Good times. Let's see. Now, coming up, today we have no guests in the studio, but we do have a topic, and that's the family. There's a chapter in the big book called The Family Afterwards, and I like to call it The Family in Recovery, because it kind of addresses a lot of stuff about how people relate to each other once a member of the family gets into recovery. It's a really weird scenario because typically with alcoholics, at least like me, and this reading I'm going to do here kind of relates pretty specifically to alcoholics. After all, it's in the book Alcoholics Anonymous.
There we go, yeah. Right? But I'm sure it's relatable to anyone in recovery and having to do with a family.
That's right, and it kind of does. And just a little preface to this is this book was written in like 1939, I think. Mm-hmm. And the main people that seemed to be involved in the program at that time were men. So it's kind of tilted mm-hmm. toward men and the typical traditional male-female family. They were use words like husband and mother and things like that.
Sure.
But this really, it can apply to anyone. There were women involved in AA back at that time. And actually in the first sentence in this book, they refer to the women who were around AA, both as members, but also as spouses at the mm-hmm. time. So
yeah, thanks for that context. That's helpful.
Yeah, it's helpful. So here we go. It's chapter 9 from the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and the title is The Family Afterward. Our women folk have suggested certain attitudes a wife may take with a husband who is recovering. Perhaps they created the impression that he is to be wrapped in cotton wool and placed on a pedestal. Successful readjustment means the opposite. All members of the family should meet upon the common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. This involves a process of deflation. The alcoholic, his wife, his children, his in-laws, each one is likely to have fixed ideas about the family's attitude towards himself or herself. Each is interested in having his or her wishes respected. We find the more one member of the family demands that the others concede to him, the more resentful they become. This makes for discord and unhappiness. And why? Is it not because each wants to play the lead? Is it not each trying to arrange the family show to his liking? Is he not unconsciously trying to see what he can take from the family life rather than give? Cessation of drinking is but the first step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition. A doctor said to us, years of living with an alcoholic is almost sure to make any wife or child neurotic. The entire family is, to some extent, ill. Let families realize, as they start their journey, that all will not be fair weather. Each in his turn may be footsore and may straggle. There will be alluring shortcuts and bypaths down which they may wander and lose their way. Suppose we tell you some of the obstacles a family will meet. Suppose we suggest how they may be avoided, even controverted to good use for others. The family of an alcoholic longs for the return of happiness and security. They remember when father was romantic, thoughtful, and successful. Today's life is measured against that of other years, and when it falls short, the family may be unhappy. Family confidence in dad is rising high. The good old days will soon be back, they think. Sometimes they demand that dad bring them back instantly. God, they believe, almost owes this recompense on a long overdue account. But the head of the house has spent years in pulling down the structures of business, romance, friendship, health. These things are now ruined or damaged. It will take time to clear away the wreck. Though old buildings will eventually be replaced by finer ones, the new structures will take years to complete. Father knows he is to blame. It may take him many seasons of hard work to be restored financially, but he shouldn't be reproached. Perhaps he will never have much money again, but the Wise family will admire him for what he is trying to be, rather than for what he is trying to get. Now and then, the family will be plagued by specters from the past, for the drinking career of almost every alcoholic has been marked by escapades, funny, humiliating, shameful, or tragic. The first impulse will be to bury those skeletons in a dark closet and padlock the door. The family may be possessed by the idea that future happiness can be based only upon forgetfulness of the past. We think that such a view is self-centered and in direct conflict with the new way of living. Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is only true if one is willing to turn to the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it's almost the only one. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that, in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. It is possible to dig up past misdeeds so they become a blight, a veritable plague. For example, we know of situations in which the alcoholic or his wife have had love affairs. In the first flush of spiritual experience, they forgave each other and drew closer together. The miracle of reconciliation was at hand. Then, under one provocation or another, the aggrieved one would unearth the old affair and angry cast his ashes about. A few of us have had these growing pains, and they hurt a great deal. Husbands and wives have sometimes been obligated to separate for a time until new perspective, a new victory over hurt pride, could be re-won. In most cases, the alcoholic survived this ordeal without relapse, but not always. So we think that unless some good and useful purpose is to be served, past occurrences should not be discussed. We family of alcoholics keep few skeletons in the closet. Everyone knows about the other's alcoholic troubles. This is a condition which, in ordinary life, would produce untold grief. There might be scandalous gossip, laughter at the expense of other people, and a tendency to take advantage of intimate information. Among us, these are rare occurrences. We do not talk about each other a great deal, but we almost invariably temper such talk by a spirit of love and tolerance. Another principle we observe carefully is that we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we are sure he would approve. We find it better, when possible, to stick to our own stories. A man may criticize or laugh at himself, and it will affect others favorably. But criticism or ridicule coming from another often produces the contrary effect. Members of a family should watch such matters carefully, for one careless, inconsiderate remark has been known to raise the very devil. We alcoholics are sensitive people. It takes some of us a long time to outgrow that serious handicap. Many alcoholics are enthusiasts. They run to extremes. At the beginning of recovery, a man will take, as a rule, one of two directions. He may either plunge into a frantic attempt to get on his feet in business, or he may be so enthralled by his new life that he talks or thinks of little else. In either case, certain family problems will arise. With these, we have had experience galore. We think it dangerous if he rushes headlong at his economic problem. The family will be affected also, pleasantly at first, as they feel their money troubles are about to be solved, then not so pleasantly as they find themselves neglected. Dad may be tired at night and preoccupied by day. He may take small interest in the children and may show irritation when reproved for his delinquencies. If not irritable, he may seem dull and boring, not gay and affectionate as the family would like him to be. Mother may complain of inattention. They are all disappointed and often let him feel it. Beginning with such complaints, a barrier arises. He is straining every nerve to make up for lost time. He is striving to recover fortune and reputation and feels he is doing so very well. Sometimes mother and children don't think so. Having been neglected and misused in the past, they think father owes them more than they are getting. They want him to make a fuss over them. They expect him to give them the nice times they used to have before he drank so much, and to show his contrition for what they have suffered. But dad doesn't always give freely of himself. Resentment grows. He becomes still less communicative. Sometimes he explodes over a trifle. The family is mystified. They criticize, pointing out how he is falling down on his spiritual program. This sort of thing can be avoided. Both father and the family are mistaken, though each side may have some justification. It is of little use to argue and only makes the impasse worse. The family must realize dad, though marvelously improved, is still convalescing. They should be thankful he is sober and able to be of this world once more. Let them praise his progress. Let them remember that his drinking wrought all kinds of damage that may take long to repair. If they sense these things, they will not take so seriously his periods of crankiness, depression, or apathy, which will disappear when there is tolerance, love, and spiritual understanding. The head of the house ought to remember that he is mainly to blame for what befell his home. He can scarcely square the account in his lifetime, but he must see the danger of over-concentration on financial success. Although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found we could not place money first. For us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded. And I'm going to take a break from that now because that's a lot of reading there.
Yes.
For me, it comes down to this. You know, once I stopped drinking, my world did not turn to rainbows and unicorns. I had merely stopped drinking. I entered into this path of recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. And as wonderful as that was for me, it did nothing for my family. I thought when I saw the garbage was full and took it out of my own accord without being asked, I thought there should be fireworks set off and, you know, a band coming in praising me. Mm-hmm. And the best my wife could muster up was like, yeah, thanks. You know, normal people do that all the time. So the alcoholic in recovery is still, like they said, convalescing, you know, for some period of time. And as far as the, you know, when they talk about the, you know, relationship, the intimacy, the chance for, you know, love affairs happening, that's something I didn't have any experience with. But I know a lot of people that have. And it can be really, really difficult to, like they say in the book, to square that with your partner. And it can be on both sides, you know, people become, you know, feel neglected, feel lonely, feel alone. And in other places in the book, it talks about the alcoholic maybe finding the girl that understands. And again, the same thing goes for the spouse. It can happen that way. You know, they feel lonely, rejected. Life is nearly impossible. They're doing all the work and they want some sort of emotional relief. And so they look outside the marriage for that. And it's sad, but it happens. And if, like they say in the book, you know, people can talk like adults and reunite with an understanding that letting bygones be bygones on that, that can be a wonderful thing. But I don't see that a whole ton either. It's difficult. I see more the case where, you know, a lot of marriages, in my experience, don't survive sobriety. just because of all the hurt and pain it's caused. And our society's lack of stick-to-itiveness in some cases. People don't necessarily take vows anymore that include till death do us part. You know, it's like, until it gets hard, and then I'm out of here. And that's unfortunate. What are your thoughts on that, Denise?
You know, there were a lot of things in that reading, and it is obvious that it was written a while back, you know, but a lot of things came to mind. For me, when I started in recovery, I felt really good about it. There was a lot of weight lifted off. I was in a really good program, lots of support and working on things. But I will say, at the time, I didn't realize the heaviness, the emotional stuff that my kids had been through. Like, I didn't really have a full picture of it. The same for my spouse at the time. I didn't really have a full picture of all the weight and all the things that had happened. I do want to say that a couple things come to mind. It does take a little bit for the finances to get in order. At least in my situation, there was a lot of really poor choices for both my now ex-husband and I, as we both struggled in addiction for around a decade, a little bit more. You know, there's just a certain point in which, for me, that I wasn't able to function and keep my business, which was sad retrospectively, but a part of my journey. And so climbing out of that and getting back into work at the same time as I was in my program, you know, was a part-time thing because my kids were young, and my ex-husband actually did pretty well at working through and during the time that he struggled in his addiction. And so we kind of stayed afloat, but it certainly wasn't what the potential at one point in our relationship was, where we were actually doing really well and owning a home and land and all those kinds of things, which even to this day is really sad. My now teenage daughters and I pass by that house quite a bit. And every now and then I share something about, you know, like what we had at that time when we moved out of that house. They were both, one was a baby and one was a toddler. And, you know, we had land. We had a horse that stayed there for a handful of months, just, you know, using our pasture. We had a four-wheeler and just different kinds of things and a boat and stuff. And that's hard for them to hear because they wish they still had those things, you know.
Right.
I had a great payment that was like $600 a month. You know, I mean, could you imagine today having your house payment be $600 and it's a three-bedroom house with land? You know, it's just, it's sometimes it's hard to look back at, but you know, today I have rebuilt and I don't have all of those things, but I have a good life and rebuilt having the things and stuff that we used to have. Again, not the same. I'm really glad when we lost our house, it actually foreclosed on us due to our bad choices, that we left with our children. You know, we got to leave with a little bit and we had our family moving forward. When you spoke of the things in there about trust broken, over the years, I learned that it's important for me, it was helpful and important to be able to sit with my kids and say, yeah, you know, and listen to what they were talking about with how they were affected emotionally and things. And same with my spouse. Honestly, that one was a little harder because we continued to butt heads a little bit, honestly, but I tried. But I think it's really important to remember that when trust is broken, that you are able to sit kindly with each other and say, hey, you remember when that happened? Like, that really hurt, you know, like I still worry about those things today. And that hopefully a couple could come to the conclusion that, like, you know, my phone, you know, my passcode, like I'm not hiding things. It's like, if you're making an amends about something and you're being honest and real and changing your ways, you know, that living amends kind of thing. I think that there needs to be a certain amount of, security and that trust that you're not doing that anymore, whatever it was, using drugs or making bad choices or,
you know, relationships.
Relationship right. Stuff. You talked about affairs and stuff. I think that things like that cause for trust to be built with open communication and the ability to see what that person is doing, you know, in that process of rebuilding trust
right. In
those kinds of situations. Again, whether it was an affair or drug use or bad decisions with finances, I think that that's a key way that that's going to happen
right. Is
that there really needs to be a way that your spouse or, you know, sometimes it's both people that made those poor choices and have broken trust, that it's just very transparent, you know?
Right.
And I do like that they said, hey, don't berate dad about stuff. It's not to say that there's never going to be emotions, you know?
Right.
I mean, the wife, the kids, the husband, there is frustration about how people were treated, kids were treated. That stuff's real. There were traumas, you know, little ones, big ones for children and spouses in those situations, at least in my home. And because we're just not our best selves when we're, you know, struggling in our addiction, whether we're drinking too much or using substances too much, whatever it looks like, we're just not our best selves. I don't care who you are, you know?
Right.
Once you take that away, I feel like I see such an improvement with people. And again, each person's different, but the potential really changes. It's like that stuff just really takes us away from who we really are. So in my life, I've seen over time where there's been just so much change and coming more back to who I am and even better.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's been really key to have people around me that are mentors, mm-hmm. good friends that are healthy and safe people to talk with things, people that are ahead of me in whatever their recovery is. It may not even be substances or anything, to be able to look to and see what they do is like a good role model even,
right.
you know,
sure.
being involved in a recovery program. So I liked that read. And I guess I would just honestly encourage people to remember that our pride or our shame might make it to where we feel like we don't want to have to show our spouse our phone, or we don't want to have to sit with our kids when they're like, hey, you know what, mom? Like, again, that really hurt me and I want to talk about it. It can be really hard, but it can also be super healing. And I've actually had a few counseling meetings with my middle daughter where I sat with her and the counselor, and she was able to talk to me about some things. She's done that with her father as well. I think that that can be helpful to have that mediator there that like knows the situation, encourages a person seeing the counselor to be able to say what they need to say. Like, it's a specific time and space where you're choosing to show up to talk about hard things.
Right.
You know, counselors are professionals. They've done this before, you know,
mm-hmm.
and some subjects can be really hard. I will share one thing that, looking back at my ex-husband and I tried to do kind of sort of like some marriage counseling, kind of sort of. It was just through the outpatient program that I was in. And I was just so fired up that I could not sit through talking through anything. It was just too early at the time. I suppose I needed more time to work on myself and the situation and my anger. I regret that didn't work out well early mm-hmm. on. My very good friend now does this kind of recovery work and kind of like Christian counseling for people. And she shares about how a lot of times at first she'll just go ahead and meet with each of them separately and they can start working on things in their lives. And then eventually she brings them together after mm-hmm. they've kind of worked on some things themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's yeah. a great way to look at it. And you know, at the time of the writing in this book, and I really wish I could read the whole chapter, but that would burn our entire time here.
Sure.
They talk about, like I said, in that first sentence, our women folk have said, mm-hmm. and a lot of the recovery that went on at that time and still goes on today is the spouses of the people coming into recovery, getting right. into recovery, will get together and share their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, counseling was not what it is today back then.
That's true.
But we have found, we being people in the fellowship, have found that we can get a lot of that same mm-hmm. work accomplished yeah. through, you know, people who have had the experience mm-hmm. and can explain, you know, why is my husband just diving into work? Now I never see him. He's sober mm-hmm. and, you know, I start to enjoy being around him and he's gone all the time. Well,
right.
you know, then they can read through this mm-hmm. book with them or yeah. share their experience and let them know this. It's probably not going to last forever.
Right.
Like it said, you know, alcoholics in recovery can be very impulsive. We really want to, you know, we're trying to make up for lost time, which yeah. you can't really do.
Mm-hmm.
Once the time is gone, it's gone. But you also need to recognize that the healing that you're doing is not just financial. There's a lot of emotional stuff that needs to be addressed in a relationship.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a wild and crazy single guy, you might think, well, that exempts me from that. But you probably still have a family or friends. that you want to rebuild relationships with, and and it affects them as well.
That's right.
So I was a bit of a victim to that, although, you know, I didn't just like wildly throw myself into work, but so many opportunities came up in early sobriety for me. And the need was there for the finances because I had left us on the razor's edge of, you know, losing it all.
Yeah.
And so I needed to do that work, but it meant I traveled a lot. So I'd, you know, be gone four nights a week and hundreds and hundreds of miles away. So, you know, driving back and forth would burn the better part of a day. And
right.
I'd get home midday Saturday, you know, work around the house, get stuff done there, try and do things with the wife. And then, you know, Sunday afternoon at four, take off again and drive 300 miles north and go to a job site and start working there. So it was difficult, although I must admit early on, she was probably just as happy to see me gone for a while because I was in recovery, but I wasn't very far recovered.
Right.
You know, early on. So I still had a lot of those sort of things I did that were still like super annoying and super alcoholic thinking, you know. Yeah. Like, oh, I got to do this. You know, this is the most important thing in the world. Well, no, pump the brakes. Maybe it's not the most important thing in the world.
It takes a little bit to adjust. I feel like being emotionally dysregulated is a big part of like early recovery and like figuring out how to do life without that substance or drink. You know, that takes a little bit of time.
Right.
And there's a lot going on too.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So there's so many things that, you know, are involved in that. And I love how they keep reinforcing in this book, you know, the idea of patience, tolerance, and love while people in recovery go through these things. And I work with men in recovery, and I sometimes hear from their spouses. One in particular called me up one time. Their neighbor had passed away, and her husband had been like the first on the scene, and you know, tried to do CPR until the paramedics got there and whatnot. And the neighbor woman passed away, and he was pretty rattled by that. And she called me up and said, "Hey, maybe you know, check on him, see how he's doing." So, being aware of the emotional state of people in recovery is important too. You do a class here for people.
Yeah.
What's it called again?
So it's called the Invitation to Change, and it's a family support group that runs for 15 weeks. Sean and I were trained a couple of summers ago for about 21 hours to be able to facilitate this class. I really love it. This workbook was actually written by the authors who wrote Beyond Addiction. And as a part of their organization, this part is a nonprofit, and that's how they do these trainings for facilitators for free. They got us started with books for free. And I really love the way that they go about this. It's very compassionate, self-care. It's about you being able to show up in your values and taking care of yourself as the family member of a loved one who struggles with addiction, either someone who is actively using or in recovery, or a family or a friend. But it's got these lessons that kind of help you wrap around, like understanding why they may choose to do such a destructive thing. Like, you know, to a person who hasn't ever experienced this, it seems kind of crazy to make this choice where you're drinking or using substances till you're half dead, lost your job, the house is foreclosed. I mean, all these things, like, that just seems crazy, you know, kind of mind-blowing. And so this kind of helps people get an idea of how could that have started? What could the person have been looking for? Is it unreasonable for someone to want to feel more at ease in social situations? Is it unrealistic for someone to want to lose weight or to use these things to help with pain? And it's not saying that it's okay. It's just saying, like, let us help you kind of find some compassion of how they got here. And then let's support you in having some conversations with them that hopefully aren't going to end in yelling and stuff.
All right.
You know, I can't even do justice explaining how awesome this workbook is, but we have gone through it. I want to say like at least four times with people, and we're going through it right now, and you are always welcome to join us. It is on Wednesdays at 5:30 and it goes till 6:45. You can come join us at any time. Like I said, no matter where we are in the workbook, I'm always willing to meet with someone either an hour before that or any other time during the week, and we will work on getting you caught up to where we are, or you can just jump in and just continue on with where we are. It is very helpful. Each lesson builds, but you can get something out of each lesson, even if you just come in the middle of it. So again, Sean and I lead that on Wednesdays at 5:30.
And how much does that cost?
It costs nothing. We provide the workbooks and the space, and Sean and I leading it. And it's just a great space, safe to be able to share what you're going through and feel supported.
Yeah. And I asked that question kind of tongue in cheek, because everything we do here is free.
It's at no cost. Yeah.
At no cost.
No cost at all. And the interesting thing about Sean and I being facilitators in this class is that we both have a loved one, family member who still struggles in this. And so even though we're people in recovery, we're able to really get a lot out of this workbook and each lesson in taking good care of ourselves and also having like an understanding of how to talk with our loved one and interact with them better.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's really helped me. And I've honestly noticed over the last year and a half that my interactions with my ex have really changed. They really have. It's a way more of a calm situation when we talk, and we just focus on, you know, co-parenting our children, and I'm not like nitpicking him or blaming him or, you know what I mean, jabbing at him.
Right, right.
And I don't feel the resentment and the hostility that I used to.
Right.
And so it's been very freeing to me. And I mean, I've been in recovery. I had been in recovery for like 10 years before that, and I still kind of struggled a bit with that.
Oh yeah, for
sure.
And
now there's just so much progress for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm in recovery now for 31 years, and I would say not a week goes by that something from the past is brought up.
Right.
Not always by the other person, sometimes by myself. And it's not always out loud. It can be just a thought in my head,
sure,
which is unhealthy. You know, it's not being... I'm not being tolerant and loving and patient, you know, and it's great for me that, you know, I can work this program and see where these character defects are popping up. Sure. You know, it's a funny thing. We work in Alcoholics Anonymous. We spend a lot of time working on defining our, what we call character defects, you know, our selfish, self-centered natures that we're trying to work on and, you know, reverse that. And once we identify them, you know, we ask for them to be removed by God or higher power, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And when you recognize them in a certain situation, you know, they can be very obvious. So when they pop up again, it's like, oh, wait, no, I know how to deal with this. However, sometimes a very peculiar situation will happen and I will react to it in a less than healthy way, and I'll have to stop and go, oh my God, that popped up again, but I didn't see it coming this time. I did not see it coming because it was dressed differently.
Right. And so you get to practice like what it looks like to apologize or make an amends. Or...
Right, right.
Don't you find you do that so much quicker now?
Oh, yeah.
I do.
And
yeah,
it even says it in our 10th step.
It does.
You know, we work judiciously to, you know, make corrections when things pop up. And they do. And like I said, you know, it's like, yeah. I should be healed by now, 31 years, right?
Well, but we're human beings. And so, you know, we don't just quarter the market on struggles with,
yeah, that's right.
with our behavior. You know, it's interesting that you brought that up. I think if it's not immediate, it's usually within 24 hours or less that I circle back around and go, you know what? Hey, you know, when I said this the other day, I'm so sorry. That wasn't, you know, and, there could be something going on in my life, the background, whatever.
Yeah.
But I still need to own that to that person because, you know, it can be helpful for me to understand why that was a particularly hard day or something like that. But right. the person honestly just needs the apology and to know that, you know, you're going to try to be better about that. At right. least that's how I feel about it, you know? And it's comfortable now to do that. I always joke that, 7 years ago, I quit smoking cigarettes.
Right.
Smoked cigarettes since I was 13 years old, you know, quit at times, pregnant with kids, nursing, you know, all those kinds of things. But, the freedom from that is pretty cool. But boy, I tell you what, that couple of weeks when I quit smoking, there was a lot of apologies that I had to make because I was really grumpy. And most of those apologies were to my little girls that are now teenagers because they were the ones around me the most. And I let them know what I was doing, but I would kneel down. I'd be like, oh, I'm so sorry that I said that or I said it in that way. And that's like the bonus part that I like from that experience was I really got comfortable with apologizing right on the spot. You know,
yeah, right.
Just like, oh, you know,
yeah, when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Yeah.
Glad to be rid of that habit. And, you know, but it was a long standing one.
Right. And no one is more blind to my character defects than I am.
Right. And that's why it's really great that you have other men around you that you talk with. I mean, right. you know, like, do you have like people who, if they were like, hey, Johnny, like, I noticed you're kind of being a little
jerkish
the other day. I mean, like, I have some females in my life that I give them permission to be like, hey, Denise, you know what? You said that you were gonna whatever, or that you weren't gonna whatever. And, you know, and so they'll bring it up kindly.
Yeah. Yeah. Men are kind of funny. We'll do it in a more sarcastic way. You know,
with
little bits like, oh, really? How'd that work out for you?
Right.
You know, sort of
kind of a little more manly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. How'd that 2x4 clock you over the head? Pretty well? Really? Yeah. What are you thinking about it now?
How'd that feel? Yeah. You want to go there again?
Sure you do. We're all kind of gentle and you guys are just like, whack. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's okay because, you know, I'm thick skinned enough that I can take it and I really will, you know, take it to heart and maybe, you know, after such commentary, I will, you know, pull that person to the side and say, wow, tell me what you really think, you know, and have that conversation, because, you know, love and tolerance is our code in AA. So, you know, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we let stuff slide. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an old saying in AA is like, we're not afraid to call BS on you.
Right.
When the time is appropriate.
Right. Cause that's a part of the program. That's part of what we're doing, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
I just wanted to say that I thought when you were talking about other people in your program and talking things through with them. And I want to say that honestly, especially, you know, if you're married or not married, but if you're married, it's very beneficial to have a couple of friends of the same, sex as you are to be able to talk with. You know, not everything has to be run through your spouse. There can be some venting or talking through before your loved one hears about it. You know, and I think that's actually really beneficial. So I would encourage people to remember that like your spouse needs guy time or girl time or whatever. And that's just healthy. You
right.
know, it's good to have friends. And if you're just a regular person, not struggling with these things, that's a good thing too. You know, you need to have community with people.
It's because what you're doing is you're not getting somebody to gang up with you on a certain person like, oh yeah, he's such a jerk.
Oh no. And your spouse can't be your only person. Yeah. You know, that's a lot.
It's hearing a different perspective on what things can look like.
Right.
And I get that a lot, you know, I'll get that from people sharing in meetings. They'll talk about something. I'm like, never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I can apply this in my own life, God forbid. Speaking of God forbid, we're out of time. So, hey, thanks for your input on this, Denise. It was really cool.
Thanks for the topic.
And I'm going to thank everyone for listening today out there in Radio Land and beyond that in podcast world, wherever you are on the planet listening to this. Mm-hmm. And I'll close it out with the regular, if you think you have a problem with substances or behavioral health, you do. And, maybe you can stop by if you're in the neighborhood, stop by at 531 South Main Street and pop into the Recovery Center and have a talk with somebody about it. Denise, maybe Sean, maybe Cindy, maybe who knows who's here.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of well-qualified and messed up people here that can relate to your problem. So we'll see you all next week. Oh, side note, I'm going to be out of town next week and the following week, so you will be getting some Recovery Radio replays. I'll try and pick out some good stuff from the past, and I hope you enjoy it. And we'll see you when we get back in town.
Bye, everybody.